You seem to be completely unaware of the Constitution of Australia.
I haven't seen what she said, but let me say I support what it is that she said.
So commit suicide, Tony Abbott.
Look, I'm going to shirt front Mr. Putin.
I was offended by those things. Misogyny, sexism, every day.
And quite frankly, they should shove her and Bob Brown in a chaff bag and take them as far out to sea as they can.
I and most Australians want our immigration policy radically reviewed. I believe we are in danger of being swamped by Asians.
Such a sycophant, a social climbing sycophant, if ever there was one.
You're not saying anything, Tony. I've given you the response you deserve.
But I ain't spending any time on it, because in the meantime, every 3 months, a person is torn to pieces by a crocodile in North Queensland.
They're communists because they shoot their own people, they haven't got a justice system, and they will take over this country.
Welcome to Convict History. This is our third episode of Convict History. Today we're going to be talking about the 2005 Cronulla riots and also the Eureka Rebellion. For this episode, I'm joined by Lucas Rosas, a writer for The Unshackled and XYZ and also popandlock.net.
Hello.
And we're also joined by political editor of The Unshackled, Michael Smythe. Say hey, Michael.
Good evening.
And also Martin Hartwig, a contributor to The Unshackled and Pop and Lock. Say hello, Martin.
G'day, cobbers.
So we're going to start off with the Cronulla riots, which were basically an outbreak of mob violence, sometimes described as race riots, in a outer suburb of Sydney, beginning on the 11th of December, and it spread over the next few nights. Do you want to give us a bit of an overview, Lucas? I know you've done some research.
Yeah, certainly. Well, as you said, on the 11th of December in 2005, you had a group of about 5,000 people, mostly, not entirely, but mostly of Anglo-Celtic background, so the Aussies from the area, and they assembled down in Cronulla and started having altercations, fights, and attacking people of Middle Eastern background, or people who they looked like they were of Middle Eastern background. They also got quite drunk, drew a gigantic Aussie pride in the sand on the beach, broke the windows of a Nando's, chased an ambulance down the street throwing beer bottles at it, and in general had a bit of a riot, mostly, which is why, hence the name, Cronulla Riots. But so, the interesting part is... Continue?
Sorry, I was just going to say, so, yeah, it is... clearly, it's pretty degenerate kind of stuff that we don't condone, but... What's interesting about the Cronulla riots is just the way that it was dealt with in the media, and certainly to me, the way that I was taught it at school, because I'm only in my 20s, so I have a decent memory, and obviously I was young at the time, so I don't have that much of a memory of what was really going on in terms of what seeing it on the news and seeing how it unfolded and having a memory of. Yeah, what the reality was, but I certainly remember being taught it in school and being taught it in a very particular way that was very averse to the background factors and what actually motivated the rioting. So do you want to go into that a bit?
Yeah, it's very interesting. That's a point I was going to bring up later, but it should really be brought up at the start, because that's something that it's really quite, like, the most fascinating part about this, because it's probably one of the more... pertinent historical events that actually happened in the early 20th century in Australia. There's like 5,000 people in a huge sort of inter-ethnic riot. That sort of stuff just isn't really a large thing that happened in many places in Australia or in the Western world during the early 21st century. But we're not really encouraged to think about it that much. We're not really encouraged to talk about it that much. Like you say, if you were ever taught about it at school at all, I've talked to people who are 17, 18, and they never heard about it even at school, right? It's really quite strange, considering that it seems like it's such a big sort of talking point. You'd assume it'd be a huge talking point for the left of politics in Australia.
Yeah,
but
definitely.
It isn't really pushed all that hard at all, right? They made a crappy movie about it a couple of years ago. It was a complete failure. Right? It isn't really held over people as a form of shame or anything along those sorts of lines. It's actually sort of tried to be brushed under the carpet for it. And I think a lot of that has to do with those background aspects that you were talking about. 5,000 people don't just show up at a beach and start attacking people for no reason. It was like clearly there were some very important motivating factors there. And without understanding what was actually going on at the time, you really have no idea of understanding the event itself at all. There is a lot of background to this event, so I'll just try and skip over some of the things that happened as quickly as possible, and then we can get on to discussing it. Because you can't really understand how the Cronulla riots came about without understanding the Sydney gang rapes that happened between 2000 and 2002. This was, as described by, not by activists or anything like this, but by the actual judiciary, which is usually a little bit left of centre at the best of times, that this was some of the worst sort of atrocities that he'd seen outside of a war zone or outside of talks about wartime atrocities. It was deliberate attacks by Lebanese extraction youths against vulnerable girls of Anglo-Celtic background. And they were attacked because of their race, they were attacked because of their ethnicity, and there was absolutely no doubt. I won't go over the gory details of it because they can get pretty disgusting. There was absolutely no doubt at all that that was the reason for them being attacked. Right? And people might ask, why would a series of gang rapes that happened in 2000 and the Ashfield rapes that happened in 2002, which were by Pakistani youths, so slightly different extraction, why would that have such a big effect in 2005? Well, a big reason for that was that there was a reporting restriction on the actual case, because it caused so much community outrage and so much tension between communities when it actually happened. There was a media blackout on it, court ordered, and that was only lifted in July 2005. So that's when all the gory details started coming out. And as someone who was about late teens at the time, right, even not living in Sydney, that was just a huge thing. We heard about it all over Australia. All of a sudden, there was a huge sort of upsurge in anger just surrounding those sorts of events. At roughly about the same time, just before the December thing that was happening, there was also the second Bali bombing, which killed 4 Australians and killed 20 people overall. It's much smaller than the original Bali bombing back in 2002, which we talked about on a previous episode, which killed 88 Australians. But at the same time, it's adding to this whole cumulative effect. Then you have the fact that riots at this time in Sydney weren't actually all that unusual. I mean, the year before, in 2004, you had the Redfern riots, where a young Aboriginal kid was running away from police and ended up coming off his bike and impaling himself on a fence pal. And the local Aboriginal community in Redfern rioted for 3 nights.
Oh, shit, I remember
and then
that. Yeah.
Early in the next year, in 2005 itself, you had the Macquarie Fields riots as well, where for almost an entire week, because Macquarie Fields, I'm not from Sydney, but from what people who are from Sydney tell me, it's not necessarily a particularly nice area. And there was riots that weren't particularly sort of ethnically based in nature. There's a mixture of Islanders and Anglo-Celtic background kids there, and they were mostly just fighting with police for a week straight every night. Now, all this sort of stuff, this is the atmosphere that's coming around and the stuff that's coming together. It all just created a sort of a bit of a tinderbox. Right? And then, but why did it come to Cronulla? And that's when you look into the police reports that came out after the riots, the police analysis of what happened and their reports of everything that happened in the sort of the lead up to it. And I'll just quickly go over those. On Australia Day that year, there was 2,000 to 3,000 just people having a patriotic day down at Cronulla Beach, and the police tried to move them on. And there are in police reports what was described as a civil disobedience, which if you read between the lines, looks like the police told them to move on and they threw their beer bottles at the police. So there's sort of like that area in Sutherland Shire, it does have a bit of a reputation as an Aussie ghetto, an Anglo-Celtic ghetto, right? It was originally sort of working class, sort of Bogan background, and has steadily become more middle class as the years have gone on, but still it's kept a bit of that. There are local
there's also
like the Bra Boys.
There's also the proximity to the train station and all that as kind of a factor for like just mass groups of people being able to quickly get there.
Huge amounts of people have always come to Cronulla because it's a nice beach from the western suburbs of Sydney. As many people pointed out in the aftermath, there was a tradition of people coming from Western Sydney to come down to Cronulla and start fights with locals. That's something that has always happened. They never really had the ethnic aspect to it until people in Western Sydney suddenly started becoming predominantly Lebanese. and that started to create more of an ethnic aspect to it. And in the year leading up between that Australia Day and between the end of the year, December, Australia Day is, of course, January 26th, long may it remain so, you ended up having a series of attacks, particularly in the long weekend in October, where you had groups of 30 in one case, 70 or over 100 in another case, of young youths of Middle Eastern appearance, as the police files would say, coming down, starting fights, attacking people, sometimes at random, sometimes attacking local groups of youths who were there and who were more than willing to be up for a fight as well. But in general, just lots of attacking going on. Right. In the late October, so that was at the beginning of October, late October, you have the four high school students getting changed in a change room, and they get attacked and fairly seriously beaten by some Lebanese men who accuse them of looking at them the wrong way. And then you have the, like, the big one, which was the, well, then there was an attack on a middle-aged man by three Lebanese men as he was leaving the RSL in Cronulla, which is a bit symbolic in and of itself. And then you have the even more symbolic one of eight Lebanese youths attacking four lifeguards, lifesavers, so volunteer lifesavers, again, for the crime of looking at them in a funny way. Like, you looking at me, bro? Something along those lines.
Now, and I have to jump in here because it's a very interesting point that has been raised in regards to why did it take so long for all of the tensions to boil over. The thing is, lifesavers are Aussie icons. I mean, yeah. The ABC even made a show called Bronzed Aussie Gods in reference to how much we revere and venerate our lifesavers.
Even
our
just
beaches.
The beach generally is seen as a symbol of Australianism.
Exactly right, Jack. And the thing is, you know, you have these people, these reprobates, attacking lifesavers. No, mate. There's going to be blowback. There's going to be people lashing out in regards to that because, you know, after everything that happened with the aforementioned incidents between 2000 and 2002, not to mention other attacks that had been unreported by the media due to the media blackout, and then finally going after lifesavers, that's a bridge too far. There's a massive backlash. It's not surprising one little bit that people finally decided, you know what? We've had enough of these scumbags attacking our people and attacking our lifesavers. You know, and what was it, Luke, you were saying about those ethnic Lebanese who were attacking that veteran, that elderly guy coming out of the RSL?
Yeah, they attacked an elderly guy, well, older middle-aged, but elderly guy outside an RSL. So outside a return service, Mr. Lee's place. And he was just walking along the street, gang attacked by three people, and they broke his ankle. And hospitalized him. And that was just, these are just the things that made the police register. And this is again like a great theme that I know, because I know the area at the time, right? And a great theme that came out of it was nobody trusted the police to doing that sort of stuff. Like after the attack on the kids in the changing room, one of their dads ended up calling up Alan Jones on 2UE. And this is a bit of a sort of a famous thing, how they started blaming Alan Jones for the riots, which was bizarre. Right. And he was saying that the police essentially counseled the attacker and let him go, which was essentially correct. They did arrest him later. How much later, the police don't, the Triple S reports don't say. And it's the same with the ones who attend the lifeguards. They essentially took down the names, let them go, and left it for an investigation later. So to the people on the ground, it looked like they were just letting these people go after that attack bit. They didn't see the later police investigations. They didn't see any sort of later police reports. The media in Sydney at the time was so averse to actually mentioning any of these crimes that the Daily Telegraph kind of political editor, Tim Blair, used to make up a joke that that it was the men of no appearance. Because every time it was every time the police report said male of Middle Eastern appearance, the Age, the ABC, the Sydney Morning Herald, all of these publications would simply blot that part out and take that description out of the police report when they were reporting it. So nobody trusted the media. Nobody trusted the police. The police even though it looks like, in retrospect, from the thing they looked like they were trying to do their job, even in some of their reports, they're blaming the locals for defending themselves, right? Saying that it's their racial prejudice which is inflaming the situation.
Yeah, I noticed that in the reports, and I thought to myself, wow, sorry to cut you off, Luke. I was reading through, I got through about half of the report this morning, just for a briefing on today's episode, and I thought to myself, wow. So instead of, instead of stopping further attacks, and, there were a couple of examples where certain, well, the names were all blotted out, obviously, were all redacted, but there were a few cases where they said, oh, this person had also been involved at such and such a point at an earlier incident. And I'm thinking to myself, and you just let him go?
What police could learn from this, and they probably have, is that if there's high-profile cases like this, that they should be able to know if something's going to generate a level of community outrage and dedicate extra resources to stomping on them, getting the issue out of the way before it boils over to a situation.
Exactly.
That is exactly what happened. When you read in the Blanchard police reports, they did. They saw that there was community outrage happening. They saw that there was a potential for violence, and they stomped down as hard as they could on the Aussie. that was kind of how it worked. And look, if you're on the Aussie there and you're on the beach and you see a group of guys attack a lifeguard, and then the guys get interviewed by the police, and then they just go away free. What do you think? Do you think they're going to get arrested again at a later date and processed duly once they have gathered all the evidence and the statements involved?
The summer heat certainly does things to a person's brain, and also you add group mentality to that. Yeah, shit's going to go down.
Well, it's like I think it's. Lifeguard thing? Sorry, go on.
What happened after the lifeguard winning thing was a bit. I'll just get through what else happened before the 11th of December. After that lifeguard thing happened, the police immediately sort of started realizing that there was huge community outrage. Because it got out. It got out through talk radio, it got out through word of mouth in particular. They ended up monitoring over 275,000 text messages calling for people to come down to the beach from both sides on December the 11th. Anyway, so after, look, the police got very, very sort of nervous about this sort of stuff. And then another lifeguard and three young Anglo-Celts were talking on the Esplanade at Cronulla on the night of the 7th of December. And they were talking about the other lifeguards being attacked. About 30 local Lebanese decided to attack them because they didn't like the way they were talking about the event, probably using some not so nice words, I imagine. And, the police did show up, and the reason they showed up is because the locals who were just in that local area, even just the local people, started fighting back, and they started ganging up together against the Lebanese, 30 or so Lebanese people there.
It's like the revenge of the nerds against the bullies.
So it's like they weren't going to let them attack another lifesaver, essentially, is what happened. The police ended up separating them, and you can see in this how things are building because the journalists were right there on the spot, and there is actually footage out there of this one you can see. And part of that footage is one of the journalists having his camera get attacked and broken by some of the Lebanese guys who didn't like having their picture taken. And he did end up getting charged eventually for that. But that night, about 11 riot police specialists arrive at the Cronulla police station, and they bring with them 60 sets of riot. So the police are gearing up, getting ready. And that was on the night of the 7th. On the 9th, so just a couple of days before the thing, Maurice Yemmer, the Premier, the ALP Premier at the time, got briefed by the police commissioner, and he went down, did a little walk around, did a little politician's walk around with lots of journalist cameras there, and told everybody that it's time to be calm and everyone needs to calm down. And clearly, everybody listened to him because nobody has ever heard of this event ever again. And everything was nice and community relations improved. So, well done, Maurice Yemmer. You're a hero. And so by the time to the morning of the 11th, people had been putting leaflets out as well, right, all through local neighbourhoods, and all people just started showing up, on the morning of the 11th. By the time it was 8 a.m., there was already a couple of thousand people there. By the time it was at its height, it was over 5,000, according to police estimates. And they pretty much rampaged through the town, although they did clean up after themselves, although they didn't clean up after smashing the Nando's windows. And, then came the revenge attack at night. Does anyone else have any more views on the events leading up to it and the day itself?
I think another thing that has that we didn't touch on this yet, the predominantly Middle Eastern Lebanese didn't just go after Anglo-Celtic Australians. They also went after they went after anyone who wasn't one of them. They attacked a guy who said, "Oh, who got asked? Do you have a problem with loops?" And he's like, "No." And they bashed him anyway. An ethnic Greek Australian got bashed as well for no reason. It's like, "Oh, you're all right, mate." They smashed his car and they beat him up. I'm like, what the hell? He just said, on the one hand, they're saying, "Oh, yeah, you're all right then, mate." Next minute, they beat the crap through him. What the hell? And they also attacked, and this was further on in the report page, it was 40s or 50s of that report that you pointed me to, Luke, is that they also assaulted a Brazilian national. So they were just, they could say, "Oh, these racist skippies are picking on us." Yeah, you used that as an excuse to attack non-Anglo-Australians and guests in our country. Yeah, nah, bugger off with that nonsense. You just wanted to fight. You're a bunch of degenerates. You just wanted to fight. That's all you wanted. And that's all they wanted. And they got what they wanted. And the sad thing is, most people still blame the Aussies for it. What a lot of people do not remember as well, and Lucas pointed this out earlier, but there are so much sexual harassment of women from the Lebs and the Westies. And it's just, well, of course they're going to get annoyed. And then once you have the lifesavers being beaten up, and the police doing nothing about it, or seeming to do nothing about it in the eyes of the average punter, yeah, people are going to be mad. And that's what it comes down to.
And the thing is, like, Aussies are pretty chill. Aussies are pretty apathetic on the most part. Like, to see 5,000 people rock up to a beach and be that pissed off, there's got to be... It's not just like, "Oh, yeah, just a bunch of Aussie racists, just, like, want to bash some cunts." It's... They're...
Essentially, you have to beat us up, rape us, and blow us up.
Like,
before we do anything.
No, that's very true. If anything, we're almost like Canadians, where we're too laid back. It's, like, frustrating.
Yeah. I remember seeing one documentary on the anniversary. I think it might have been Vice or SBS or some other sort of cut look back on it. It was white supremacist racist. And they focused very heavily on an event. I don't know if you're going to cover this later, Luke, where a bunch of the white Aussies converged on a train where they believed that a whole carriage load of Lebos were coming in. And they couldn't find anybody, so they just started attacking these two poor random dudes who were there on their own. And, like, the journos were there, like, filming it, like, "Oh, this is great, we can use this later to..." it's obviously misdirected anger.
They used it later to incriminate those guys. Those guys got arrested. They had a huge... The media was nearly always so reticent in naming and shaming any of the people who created the situation in the first place with their offences. It was all of a sudden completely on board with showing random people's faces or people's faces who may have been involved all over the front pages of the Daily Telegraph and the Sydney Morning Herald.
Yep. If you
all trying to get them done.
Yeah.
People don't trust the mainstream media anymore.
Yeah. If you look up Cronulla riots, all that you will see is the faces immortalized of angry, like, screaming Aussie rioters on that day. Yeah, that's a very good point. There's no...
To be fair, the journalists weren't going to go out at night when the Lebs came around, 100 Lebs came around the baseball yeah. and started smashing up streets.
Mm.
They weren't going to get anywhere near there. They knew what would happen to journalists in that situation.
What happened to the press photographer? What happened to the press photographer? Got his camera and equipment smashed. Yeah, they know that they'd get an ass kicking from the Lebs if they went out at night. I mean, really? There's some areas in Sydney you just don't go.
Really makes you
and
think.
A riot and the surrounding environs of a riot ground zero is in those places where you just don't go. And journalists are pretty, how do I put this, generally, I mean, present company accepted, I mean, although I wouldn't call us journalists as such, we're not part of the conventional,
we're citizen journalists, we're not part of the conventional.
Yeah, we're citizen journalists. We're not part of the conventional fourth estate, which are a bunch of cowards and pansies, really, to be honest. But yeah, they wouldn't go. They wouldn't go after dark. They want to have their little dinners and drinks with friends. No, we can report on that tomorrow.
Oh, would you like to come up to my apartment for some nose beers?
Oh, I would very much like that. Thank you, sir.
All right, cheers. So, all right, shut up. I just came across some interestingly subversive propaganda. This is a research paper or something, a conference paper published from Murdoch University in 2010. Murdoch University is in Western Australia, by the way. And in its introduction, it cites that there were supposedly conflicting versions of what had aggravated the fight between the attack on the three lifesavers on the 4th of December. It references someone by Professor Scott Poynting, who, just from a quick Google, is a regular contributor to The Guardian and writes about spooky, far-right extremism is constantly on the rise, or no.
Imagine my shock.
He claims... that the lifesavers had insulted their assailants with public taunts. Quote, Lebs can't swim. Oh, well, if they publicly taunted them, well, yeah, I guess that's a bit of a different story. The other...
Clearly, that entirely justifies gang bashing them.
Yeah, the alternative...
Like, didn't you learn that in, like, primary school, like... Somebody says mean words to you. It's not okay.
Walk away. Yeah.
I learned that in primary school. I used to lash out. I used to get in fights in primary school. And a teacher in year six was like, you know, if you keep this up, you're going to end up in prison. That's really something to think about.
The alternative version offered was that the conflict arose because the Lebanese had come to the beach and verbally abused a bunch of local Australian women with phrases such as, you are an Aussie slut, you bunch of Aussie sluts, and you should be raped. So,
which, considering the temperature of at the time, the climate at the time, that doesn't really seem all that out of the ordinary.
Well, it certainly makes more sense than the Scott Poynting's version of the, oh, Lebs can't swim. Yeah, let's go bash them.
The revenge attacks.
All right.
Go on to the revenge attacks that happened that night. Right, so basically, a bunch of 5,000 Aussies wandered around fairly disorganized. There was no central organization, no matter how much the media tried to find something later. It was genuinely just friendship groups contacting each other and all showing up at the same place at the same time. It was actually a spontaneous
event. Yeah, it was a massive text chain, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was a huge text chain. This is before people were relying on Facebook.
Yeah.
Or even really relying on MySpace. All right, this was back in that pre sort of social media age.
Before the government got to the internet.
Yeah, before pretty much you could contact people like through your Facebook and all the social pressure that comes with that. So yeah, text chains were very, very, very difficult for police to trace. And they only really got a handle on how much sort of text messages were going out afterwards. Even then, they tried to sort of find who was organizing it, who was doing this, who was doing that, and they never found it. It was all pretty much an organic, spontaneous thing, which makes it when you look into so many of the protests and sort of stuff that happened in Australia today, there's none of them that are spontaneous. They're all highly organized by highly dedicated and disciplined groups of people, right, in almost every single state. It's phenomenal. That's why it's such an incredible event, the Cronulla Riot. I mean, the next night as well, that wasn't centrally organised by any group either. It was simply groups of Lebanese friends who knew each other getting together in carloads and going down and smashing up streets in Cronulla and in Maroubra. And this is where it comes into it again, because although the police reports don't say anything about it, the accepted wisdom at the time, from amongst, particularly amongst the locals who were there, was that the police had let them come in, that the police had seen these convoys of tens or even dozens of cars coming in and had just simply waved them through and allowed them to come and attack because the police had been embarrassed so badly that day. There's no evidence
that the police dropped the ball. Sorry, go on.
Yeah. No evidence of that being the case, but a hell of a lot of anecdotal evidence that it's the case. So whether or not, considering how many rumours were flying around, there was at one stage saying one rumour saying there was going to be a drive. There was a drive-by shooting outside the North Cronulla pub, which never actually happened. So there was an awful lot of rumours flying around. But that's one that has stuck around to this day, talking from the district, that the police not only didn't crack down on the Lebanese gangs beforehand, they actually let them make their revenge attacks afterwards. Some of those attacks were pretty over the top. They had hundreds of people coming down with metal bars, attacking people, smashing up cars, smashing up the streets. They had one group of Lebanese guys got together and they desecrated an Australian flag, spat on it, stamped on it, rubbed it up their asses, and then one guy set it on fire. And unfortunately, he had very flammable tracksuit pants on and set fire to his own leg as well.
Oh, that's unfortunate.
Yeah, very unfortunate. And there was another Lebanese guy who actually took down the flag from outside an RSL and burnt that one as well. And he actually got caught eventually, that guy. And one guy got stabbed in the back trying to protect his girlfriend just when a couple of carloads of Lebanese guys just jumped out and attacked him on the side of the street. It's amazing looking back because, and this is the big thing, those sorts of attacks and those sorts of things, after the Cronulla riots, and even the sorts of beat harassment and that sort of stuff that had prompted it in the first place, they all kind of died off.
So I do remember the media coverage of it. I do recall hearing about the Lebanese, going on the night two or three of it, I think, going out and smashing cars up. I do remember the media covering that. The most memorable thing about it is that ginger guy with the "Wogs out of Nullah" written on his chest, and the footage of that absolutely beefy cop with the baton holding back 20 angry, drunk white Aussies, just doing big 180 swings, get back. Where is he now? I'd like to know.
Heart attack ward.
It was very striking footage of the just the mobs of angry guys, always holding beers and Aussie flags, and I thought it was pretty shocking for me at the time. I wasn't a very political person back then, apart from being into 9/11 conspiracy theories.
but who wasn't? Some of us still are.
I was ahead of the curve, man. When I was 13, I was walking around school handing out printouts, come on, guys, you got to open your eyes.
It's a false flag, man.
It's a false flag. They're like, what's a false flag?
Jet fuel, man.
So let me get to my Mac.
I'm sorry. Do I need to go to my kitchen and get some tin foil?
Yeah, what if we opened up? Come on, we're at 35 minutes already. Let's move on. What?
Probably a good idea. Yes.
So the Eureka Rebellion was a rebellion, as the name suggests, occurred in 1854, also early December, the 3rd of December, in Ballarat, what is now called Eureka. I've been referring to it as kind of like the Australian 1776. It's not quite as...
Quite a lot smaller scale.
It's quite, yeah. I refer to it as that in the sense that it has a heavy sort of dose of... It's sort of like Ned Kelly. It's a part of our Australian convict mythology, if you like. It was basically a rebellion of gold miners, so working class against the colonial authority of the United Kingdom. Was it over a tax increase?
It was over the levying of the tax.
So basically, yeah, right. Oh, the yeah, no, you're right. It was expense of a miner's license, yeah.
Yeah.
And taxation without representation.
Yeah. No, 30 shillings.
That's exactly what I was going to say. It was a no taxation without representation thing.
Issue, yeah. So that's, sorry, yeah. No, sorry. I'm re-realizing why I've been calling it Australian 1776. Yeah, just as I read that. Finally. Yeah,
it's, you, look, just going to the background of that just really quick, is just people don't realize just two things. How much gold was in Victoria at that time? I mean, for the like whole of the gold rush up until the beginning of the 20th century, it was almost, I think, 2 million kilos taken out, almost like under 2 million kilos of gold taken out of Victoria. And outside of California in the middle of the 19th century, it was the largest source of gold in the world at that time, Victoria.
Where'd that gold end up?
Victorian, like the actual state of Victoria, colony of Victoria as it was then, right, pretty much like by the, in the 1830s, they couldn't hold an accurate census because there simply weren't enough Europeans around to hold an accurate census. By the 1860s, they had almost 600,000 people in the colony. So within 30 years, it went from almost too small to count to significant size of people. Melbourne went from like 10,000 people in 1840 to 125,000 by the end of the 1850s. It was just a gigantic, huge increase in population in a tiny period of time. And nearly all of these people came from the United Kingdom, so Great Britain and Ireland. Right, a large amount, usually more from leftist historians, comes later that you have a large amount of people coming from Italy or that sort of stuff. And there was a large amount of people from China, of course, as everyone knows. But it really wasn't that big of a thing in that regard. And talking about whether or not it's the Australian 1776, do you guys know anything about the Chartist movement?
No, it's been a while. It's been a while since I've read
about it. The liberal revolutions in the middle of the 19th century in Europe.
Oh, you mean 1848?
Yeah, that's
the year that Europe went to hell.
albeit
for only a few days before what they called the Holy Alliance stepped in and curb stomped the anarchists and such, or proto-anarchists and such.
Yeah, a lot of the people like the Italians and that's in the Central Europeans who were on the gold fields came as refugees from there. So former radicals from there. That's where the radical edge of the rebellion came from. But the majority of people were working class people from Britain who had only just arrived in the last 20 years. Because before that, there was barely anybody there. Melbourne essentially just built itself in that period of time, which is why so much of the architecture there today is still mid-19th century Victorian. And so much like 10 years before the gold rush really came along, a crazy man named Hoddle set out all the streets in that grid pattern that it has today in the CBD and made all the streets like 20 meters wide. And everyone thought, you're crazy for a town of like 10,000 people. You're insane. But it worked out eventually. But the Chartist movement in Britain was essentially the male suffrage sort of move. They wanted no property qualifications to stand for office. They wanted all males over the age of 21 to have a vote. No property qualifications for vote. So it's a liberal sort of movement, very strong in working class people, the exact people who ended up coming to Victoria to go to the gold fields. I mean, and the amount of people, there were 20,000 miners at Ballarat alone. And 30 years before that, there hadn't been 20,000 Europeans in all Victoria. So these people had pretty much just transplanted these ideas from Britain, from the sort of radical edge in Europe, and landed them in Australia. And you see that in meetings on Bakery Hill that they had, the oath that they swore to each other, their demands even, and the demands that they said. It's like, why should we follow old rules in this place when we didn't want to follow them in the last place?
And the Chartists, yeah, there was another thing they did as well. I mean, in addition to what you said, they also campaigned which is ironic thinking of it now, Liberals and Catholics teaming up together. But the Charterists were also in favour of removing the restrictions on Catholics in social life and in community life as well. That's another reason why I remember the Chartists, albeit very vaguely. But
yeah, that was the early Chartists, because I think that by the time they really sort of got into a big movement, the Catholic emancipation thing had already been done, just vaguely trying to remember my 19th century British parliamentary history.
Yeah, it's very convoluted. It's like, when did Wilberforce come in, Salisbury, Shaftesbury, etc. But it's a mess to remember it all. I should know more about British history. But what I was going to say, in addition to your excellent points, Luke, is that we touched on the no taxation without representation thing, and how 1854 is, in a small way, but no less significant way, our equivalent of America's 1776. The thing was, after the crushing of the Eureka Stockade, I think it was Hotham was the governor at the time?
He was the governor at the time, Hotham.
Yeah, Hotham realized, okay, maybe we should ease up on the license, because bear in mind, £1 back then was a lot of money.
It was 30 shillings. 30 shillings was the license cost. No idea how that translates. I can't do it real. Yeah, 30 shillings.
Anyway, the fact that it was a pound, a guinea, or 30 shillings doesn't really matter, because point is, at that time, it was worth a lot of money. And as a result,
if you're a miner who's not successful, that's going to create a lot of pressure on you. You've got a wife, you've got kids. You know, you're not getting that lucky. You're not getting lucky, and then you see a bunch of, you know, Manchurians, and that, fed income. And you're probably going to get pissed off.
Please don't do a Rowan Dean. Ross Cameron. Please don't do a Ross Cameron, Martin. But seriously, though, Martin's got a point. The fact that there was so much money you're forking out up front before you actually strike gold, that's going to cause a lot of pressures. And not to mention that there were actually the police of the time were actually checking and making sure that these people had their licenses, and they're also being unduly harassed in cases of those who actually did
because you've got the fact that, like I said, this place had just popped up out of nowhere, this place called Victoria. Right. They desperately needed police, and pretty much the only place they could get it was other colonies, which meant that primarily they got them from Tasmania, and the population of Tasmania at that time was nearly all freed convicts. So they had a huge amount of police inspecting licenses on the goldfields who were all ex-convicts and who were getting a part of the fine if they managed to find someone without a license. That was like their personal bounty.
So basically, they had an interest in being
insanely corrupt.
Being belligerent. Oh, I was just going to say belligerent, but insanely corrupt works too. I was just
pretending. And then you have the James Scobie incident, where a miner. That's what set it all off. Right? It was a miner was killed in a fight with owner of the Eureka Hotel, which is where the name of the rebellion comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And basically he got taken to court very quickly, the hotel owner, and amazingly enough was found innocent by a magistrate who was also his business partner. Naturally, the miners got quite a bit upset about this and held a rally of 10,000 people, which is half the miners on the mine at the time, outside the hotel to protest. And a couple of guys got a little bit carried away and the entire hotel got burned to the ground. Then another magistrate, a few days later, suddenly decides, maybe we can convict this guy of manslaughter as long as we also convict these guys for burning down his hotel, which just made a mockery of the entire thing. And at that stage, people were just so angry about everything that had been going on that it just snowballed from there. The meetings kept going, they kept getting bigger, and they started negotiating with Hotham and with the local mines commissioner as well. The negotiations went nowhere because, of course, they weren't willing to give in. And, yeah, it slowly headed towards building a stockade and stockpiling a ridiculously small amount of weapons. I mean, they only had about 50 working guns at the end. It wasn't really all that well planned of a rebellion.
I don't know if I'd call it a rebellion, though, as such. I mean, yeah, we refer to it as a rebellion, but was it really intent to throw over the government?
No,
though?
It's a civil, yeah, it's civil disobedience, really. It's a civil uprising.
More or less, yeah.
Yeah, it's hardly an insurrection. It's like, no, we just want to get a fair go. That's basically what it was. And, yeah, Peter Lawler, the leader of the, well, the most preeminent leader of the Eureka Stockade, he actually ended up being pardoned and getting into Parliament at some point and even refused the knighthood from Queen Victoria.
And funnily enough, as I've always found incredibly amusing, he ended up starting a very successful business in Melbourne after that. And when the workers tried to form a union, he hired strikebreakers to attack them.
Seriously? Oh, wow. Yep.
Which is why, you know, all those unionists carrying around a Eureka flag. I mean, it's always been ridiculous.
Yeah, it is pretty ridiculous.
It's always been ridiculous. It's a tax rebellion. It wasn't, look, it's a tax rebellion of small business owners, owner-operators, protesting against an unjust tax, right? It's essentially what the Yellow Jackets are doing in France right now. Okay, it's nothing to do with the union movement, which came later, right? The union movement, and particularly their political arm, the Labour Party, are all about higher taxes, yeah, and overbearing government.
Yeah.
The very things that the Eureka Stockade people were fighting against. So the idea that the union movement has any right to the Eureka flag is absurd. But it is nice to watch them like squeal and scream whenever you like you try and say that it isn't, because they're very attached to it. It's a lot of fun.
There's a there's also a very old British film made about the Eureka Stockade. It's just called Eureka Stockade.
Yeah, I think I've seen it. Old black and white one. It's pretty good, actually.
Oh, okay.
This is the reason why Hotham in particular was so reluctant to actually bargain. This is a thing that doesn't come out all that much. The Treasury building in Melbourne, anyone who's been down there and seen it, it's a lovely building. It was built all at that time, and it was built to hold gold, right? There were 2 tons of gold going through that building every week. And it was huge amounts of gold going through there. And even huger amounts of it were simply walking away, because all these foreign people, particularly from Californians, were coming over in large numbers, dirty Americans, filthy, dirty Americans, probably none named Emilio, but they're filthy, dirty Americans. They were coming over and taking the gold and going back to America. The Chinese in particular were sending all their gold back home. They had no intention of staying, most of them. They fully intended to take their gold back to China, where it was worth a hell of a lot more.
Exactly.
Europeans in particular were doing the same thing. So Hotham was watching all his gold walk out of his colony. At the same time, he was being asked by the colonial authorities to build gigantic amounts of infrastructure for all these new people. He needed all that gold. And at the same time, Britain was taking nearly all of the gold that he was able to stockpile to pay off Britain's foreign debt, which was still going back to the Napoleonic Wars. So in other words, he's raking in as much gold tax as possible whilst everyone seems to be taking it away from him. Right? In particular, the British government, a significant proportion of the debt that had been accrued during the Napoleonic Wars was paid off by the gold from Victoria, right? Which allowed the British to then loan more money and actually sort of help to fuel the late 19th century expansion into places like Africa. Right? It was just... Even on world scale, the gold rush in Victoria was incredibly important, which just puts the Eureka Rebellion on an entirely different level to what it's normally held.
What do you expect when you have Disraeli and Gladstone as prime ministers at the time?
So we hope you all enjoyed episode number three of Convict History. Be sure to check out popandlock.net for more analysis and commentary from all of us. Thank you, as always, to The Unshackled for distributing us on YouTube. Check out their coverage. And thanks for tuning in. Take care of each other, and we'll see you next week with another podcast.
Toodaloo.
Good night.